Today's show is dedicated to the memory of Katie Snyder Evans, a longtime member of the online Mormon community who was killed by a drunk driver while returning home from visiting her newborn twins at the NICU. A support fund for the family has been established, and we will include a link in the show notes. All Patreon donations to the Mormon News Report podcast for the month of October will be donated to this fund. Katie leaves behind her husband, Jacob Evans, her children, Spencer, who is 12, Travis, 11, Nathaniel, 9, Gideon, 2, and her preemie twin girls, Hannah and Sarah, who are not even 8 weeks old yet. Our heartfelt thoughts are with the Evans family during this incredibly difficult time.
Welcome to the Mormon News Report podcast for the week of October 23rd, 2017. We are your weekly dose of Mormonism.
With a helping of snark to make even the harshest of critics roll their eyes at our ridiculousness. And I'm talking of you, Brian, not of me.
Hey, yeah, speak for yourself there, Brant. So listen, we have a fun show today. Novelist Stephen Peck is going to be here to join us and talk about his new book, Gilda Trillium, Shepherdess of the Rats.
Brian, rats. This book is about rats.
Kind of.
And about Gilda. But reading his book, I'm not kidding you, I had a spiritual experience with rats. That's something I never thought I would say before. So before we get into all that, before we get into the news and everything, Mr. Whitney, you were a busy man this week out grinding, trying to make a dollar holler. Tell me a little bit about your road trip diary, because I heard you were a little bit busy.
So do you want to hear about the Joseph Smith Papers Conference I attended on Friday, or my interview with Richie Stedman from the Cultural Law Podcast? Or do you want to hear highlights from my ward's primary program from today?
Let's start with our friend Dick Stedman, because I'm sure Richard will love this. And by the way, everyone, we just want to give a quick shout out. We are on the Cultural Hall podcast. They are our sister podcast. They have articles of news. They've got interviews. And now you've got us, the Mormon News Report, on them. So if you're interested in all things Mormon, you should check them out as well. So tell me a little bit about this whole thing with Richie. I was shocked that you even did an interview. I didn't know that this happened until all of a sudden I looked at my phone. It was like... Apparently there's an interview with Brian.
To be honest, I didn't even know that he knew my name, right? Like, you know, he sent me a message and said, hey, you know, you should probably do an interview here because I guess you're on this other podcast. So anyway, I happened to be down in Salt Lake City for the Joseph Smith Papers conference on Friday. And Richie said, hey, while you're down here, do you want us to come down for a half hour? And, you know, I'll put you on the spot with numerous questions and make you feel like a complete moron afterwards. And I said, hey, that's, you know, nothing sounds better than that. Like literally. And I walked down there after we had a little luncheon and hung out in his office with him, studio rather, not really an office. And he grilled me on a few things. It was pretty lighthearted, you know, but it's one of those things, Brant, when you get done, you're like, what did I say?
Oh, believe me.
Oh my gosh.
There have been a couple of times I've done interviews and I've Monday morning quarterbacked myself to death. Like, oh gosh, I shouldn't have said this. I could have said this better. Oh, that's going to be taken out of context. But Brian, I will tell you this. You had a quip in there about Brigham Young and the phrase kiss my ass that everybody needs to listen to, because I was like, I was driving and I listened to that and I was like, oh, did he just say that? Oh no, it's okay. Yeah. It was Brigham Young. It was a quote, so it's okay.
Right. Well, my philosophy in life, Brant, is that the only swears that anybody should be allowed to use is either stuff that comes directly from our scripture canon or from Brigham Young, which kind of leaves it wide open, to be honest.
I mean, that's kind of everything. So I'm good with that. You know, hey, and you know what? That's what I'm going to tell my wife next time is, hey, it's not me. I mean, Brigham Young said it. So if he can say it, I can say it, you know.
And if not Brigham Young, then you can always pull up J. Golden Kimball. So, you know, I mean, we you know, the salt of the earth. Right?
We've got our scriptural examples right there. There's precedent, so you can't be mad at me. So okay, you named drop just a little bit there. The Joseph Smith Papers Conference. I'm not going to lie. You were texting me updates as it was happening, and I was so incredibly jealous because there was a big announcement that came
out. Well, I do it. I do it just to make you jealous because I know there's no way that you're going to be able to see this because
they
didn't film it. They're not going to be publishing it. You're out in Detroit. So I'm just like, yeah, I think I'm just going to make him jealous for most of the day and tell him how awesome this is. So yeah, it was put on for Documents Volume 5 and Documents Volume 6 of the Joseph Smith Papers, which takes the historical record through Ohio, through most of Missouri, and kind of up towards the end of Missouri before they are expelled and end up in Nauvoo. So a lot of really cool stuff. The idea was is that the presenters were supposed to be basing their papers on research material that they could glean from documents 5 and 6. Sometimes that happened, sometimes it didn't. I will give you one example of a spot where it horrifically didn't and made everybody cringe. So spoiler alert on that. But some great papers were presented. Ben Park was there, which I think Ben Park presented like three papers throughout Utah this past week. So basically everywhere that a paper could be presented, there was Ben Park, right, giving a paper. And of course, his paper was excellent, and it put Mormonism into context with larger American social trends and all that neat stuff. So
let me ask this. How was Ben Park's shirt and tie combo? Was it on fleek, as the kids are now saying?
Oh, it was on fleek. It was on fleek. And when he stood up to the podium too, he gave himself a good little self-deprecating joke, right? He said that he was going to, you know, with all these responsible historians around, he was going to, you know, hopefully build on their legacy by irresponsibly handling the history from that point forward. So, you know,
Ben Park, he's a normal guy like the rest of us. You know, he could poke fun at himself.
Hey, I don't know. I don't know that I would go as far as call him normal like the rest of us, Brandt. I mean, there's something going on there with Mr. Park. But at any rate, enough of Mr. Park. The paper that was presented in the later afternoon session, I don't even remember who the presenter was, but let's just say that they decided to go all Heartlander model on us, right?
Oh,
which
boy.
Joseph Smith Papers Conference is probably not the appropriate place. And for listeners who are like, what is that, like a bread line or like, what is that? It's a theory that the Book of Mormon geography took place in North America, around the Great Lakes area and in the New England area. And they're rather persistent about this theory. Like I get having good theories about where this took place and entertaining pieces of evidence. But these people are a little bit kind of on the rabid side. Like, no, this is exactly where it went down. And I can tell you, I can give you a tour of Zarahemla tomorrow if you want to go with me. Right. And it's just a little bit fringe science, I guess you can say. Right. And then you got it seems to attract a lot of people who tend to be, I don't know, like kind of the prepper mentality, like they're prepping for the end times and like, you know, really kind of far right people. And so it's just a really weird group. And you wouldn't expect in the Joseph Smith Papers Conference, which is pretty academic, for infiltration, as it were. And it did happen. They asked him not to. I think his name is Richard Neville, now that I think about it. They asked him not to because they knew that he was a guy who supports the theory, but he's got other interesting things to say, and they're really hoping that he would do the other interesting things. Mm-hmm. And he did to a certain point, and then he launched right into his Heartlander, at which time one of the Joseph Smith Papers volume editors raised his hand and said, "So tell us exactly, out of Document 5 and Document 6, what documents you used to support this paper." And he was like, "Well, I didn't really catalog it that way." I was like, "What? What kind of an answer is that?" So anyway, it went a little off the rails at that point, but it got back on, and there were some amazing papers in the final session. Okay, big announcement.
The big news.
That was a terrible drum roll. Big announcement was during lunch, Matthew Groh, who we've had on the show, presented at the lunch that was catered and announced several projects that the Church Historians Press is going to be doing. Most of which are going to be either in conjunction with or after they've finished the Joseph Smith Papers project. One in particular that got everybody super excited is the William McClellan Journals. Now, let me just explain.
I was just going to say, I've heard bits and pieces. I think I know when it's important, but from what I'm understanding, the fact that the Church Historians Press is going to publish this is a big deal, because they're going to publish it in its entirety. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, there may be some redacting on sensitive temple language, but outside of that, I think, you're going to see it in its entirety. So William McClellan was the scribe to Joseph Smith throughout most of Nauvoo, and he was there at like everything, right? Like he recorded everything, and he had pretty good journal keeping capabilities. We've never had his journal completely open. Well, I can't say never. It's been a long time since we've had his journal open for researchers to be able to go in and use it to look at. So what we have had in the past, Signature Books put out a publication called the William McClellan Journals, but they were really kind of a hodgepodge collection of what fragments that they could find. It's almost like the Book of Abraham papyri, right? Like there's these fragments that they've tried to kind of pin together and create this narrative out of. Well, now we will have the full meal deal, everything that he's recorded, but it's not going to be for a while. This is, from what I understand, they're not planning on really launching into this until after they're finished with all the Joseph Smith Papers volumes.
So then why is the fact that we're going to have McClellan's diaries a big deal? Aside from the fact that he's been at everything, was he
right? So there's a lot of questions. Yeah, there's a lot of questions about plural marriage, for instance, and there's not a lot of early accounts on that, a lot of contemporary accounts on plural marriage. Mm-hmm. Most of what we have are all later recollections and reminiscences and affidavits that were filled out, you know, 20, 30 years down the road. So to have more contemporary witness of it kind of dispels some of those arguments that are floating around about whether or not Joseph actually did or did not personally practice plural marriage. So we're hoping that William McClellan's diaries will contain some of those marriages that were performed, right? So that it would help out the historical record on that.
And I would guess, a lack of a better term, he was in the inner circle. So he would, in essence, have a firsthand view of everything that's going on. He would know, for example, like you said,
probably. Yeah, it was an on the ground view. So, right. You know, if you know, probably one of the most important documents out of the Nauvoo period that just has not been open. So, yeah, anyway, big deal.
That's nice. But Brian, the big news of the week, it was your primary program today.
Oh man, you know, I love primary program, Brant.
It is the best.
It is the best, you know. And so, you know, I was thinking about like some of my favorite parts of it. And so like, okay, here's my top three. And if you have anything to add on primary program, Brant, please feel free. Number one, the kid who gets up to the microphone and just gets completely frozen in space, right? Who gets completely just shocked at how many people are sitting out there in the audience staring at him, freezes up and stands there and stares at nothing for like an entire minute, right? Love that kid.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, the kid who's completely oblivious to the fact that anybody's watching him and is sitting there in his seat just digging away at his nose, fully committed, right?
Yep. He's up to the third knuckle by this point.
Love that kid, right?
Yep.
And let's see, what was another good one, Brant?
So while you're thinking, here's one that popped into my head. I remember a primary program where we were at where it was similar to your number one, except the kid gets up there. He was probably about a 7-year-old boy, gets up there, full head of steam, full confidence, steps right on up to the stool, right on the podium, hands gripping the side of the podium in full general authority grip, and said, "I believe." It was the best. And I'm not kidding you. It was in my in-laws ward, and I had to like leave because I was laughing so hard. It was so confident kid who completely spaces out. Like that's another good one.
Right. Yeah. And then there's the over ambitious kids who want to make sure because their parents told them, sing nice and loud, Susie. Oh, yeah. And so they're out there just like screaming their guts out like some sort of a hardcore thrash metal band. Right. Gotta love those kids. They're just over dominating everybody. Right.
A for effort, A for enthusiasm. Maybe we'll give them a C for actual execution. So here's my primary program story. And I think you can appreciate this because your kids are a little older than mine. But my oldest is 3.5 years old. So this year was the first year that she was doing the primary program. She is not the most outgoing kid. She's very conservative. She's very introverted. And frankly, she's very shy. So we've been working with her like, okay, Evie, tell us your line. What's your line? Okay. And we would work with her. She gets up there as one of the first speakers in the primary program, gets up to the podium, waves at everybody, and nails her line just perfectly. And Ashley and I look at each other and we're like, is that our kid? Did our kid really do that? We talked to someone later and they're like, that was the best, like just having her wave. So we asked Evie later. We were like, okay, so what was the deal with the wave?
And was it like elbow, elbow, wrist, wrist wave too, like parade style wave?
Like Miss America wave.
Oh, that's so nice.
You know, like tilting the wrist. And so we, you know, my parents were in town. And so we had asked her like, was it because grandma was waving at you? And she goes, no, I just wanted to say hi to everybody.
Well, that's so sweet.
So that's my 3.5-year-old.
You know, the sweetness of it, though. I mean, I'm teasing about some of his kids, but just the sweetness of the primary program. I could, you know, I'd probably be happier going to church every week. And I think everybody says this. I'd probably be happier going to church every week if I knew that I was going to be faced with a primary program. Anyway.
It's the best.
Let's get on with the news.
All right. Brian, we got a couple of big stories this week. First one is from the Huffington Post. This is from Megan Connolly. I found feminism in the land of Mormon women. And we've all talked in the past about how important headlines are. Let me just read a couple of pieces and we got to get into this. It was in Provo I learned to love women wildly different from me. And it was in Provo that I learned to love the woman I am still becoming, even though she is wildly different from what I have always been told to expect. For me, a natural result of this love has been a feminism as expansive as my now discarded map of womanhood was restrictive. My family and I left Provo for the Bay Area 3 years ago. We moved to a community that has accepted us and instructed us with equal measures of grace. We love it here. Last week, I took a new friend out for lunch. When she found out we lived in Provo just a few years ago, she hooted. Huh, I can't imagine what that would have been like. I smiled and then said, well, first, let me tell you about all the women there. Okay, Brian, we've got an interesting dynamic on the show. You're in Utah. I'm in Michigan. We come from varied backgrounds, but I will say this. For those of us outside of Utah, I think it's pretty easy to bag on Provo. I actually had a close friend, hi Jenny, just returning your shout out, who told me once that she actually gets really irritated when people bag on Provo because she wants to respond to them and say, no, stop. Provo is not BYU. I actually love going to Provo. And I think if you can make it past the BYU parts of things, it's a really, really cool downtown to go to. So let me ask you this. Is what Megan Connolly's saying, is that accurate where Provo is this diamond, this feminist diamond in the rough? Or was she just looking at one side of it? And what are we supposed to make of this news story?
Well, so scientifically speaking, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, right? And I'm sure that when we get Stephen Peck on later on, he can discuss the scientific elements of Provo and how you have this strange dichotomy and dynamic where you have this kind of overbearing majority of Mormons that are in the area, and a lot of them are going to be, you know, on the conservative side. So because of that, you end up with a really strong underground backlash that I think is really, particularly with the next generation of millennials, rising up, right? So I think personally that Provo is actually becoming one of the more liberalized areas of Utah. And I'll even go a little further. I think BYU isn't quite as stodgy or curmudgeonly as they once were. I mean, they have caffeine now, Brant.
I know. I mean, listen, for BYU, that was like a step into the 20th century. Welcome, guys. We like to have you here. But Brian, you're not wrong. Yeah, we salute you, and we will crack open a cold one for you. But you're not wrong. But at the same time, I think that there is while there is this equal and opposite reaction, and we're going to have to go to Stephen later for confirmation on this. I think we're on solid ground there. But I think what also starts happening is when you have these two groups like this, especially this underground group, you start seeing the dividing lines start becoming firmer and firmer. And so on the one hand, while I could go to downtown Provo, and there are some like really amazing for Provo, mind you, some really amazing progressive places in Provo. I'm thinking of, our friend Brad Kramer's shop in Provo, Written Vision. I'm thinking of some of the bookstores out there, even some of the restaurants out there. It's like, wow, this is pretty cool. The rooftop
progressive menu.
I know. I mean, listen, you want me to tell you about a progressive menu? There's a restaurant there that serves Navajo tacos, and it was $20 a taco. And my wife and I looked at the menu. And we were like, I think we're just going to get something to drink.
It's like $5 everywhere else. So speaking of Provo, Brant, the most important thing in Provo, perhaps, arguably, is Studio C. And you know that this, and I'll tell you why they're the most important thing in Provo, because they made the front page of Wall Street Journal this week.
Okay, so this is a joke, right? The venerable, themed Wall Street Journal doing a story on Studio C?
No, it's totes legit, as the kids like to say.
Holy crap. Okay. All right. So Bradley Olson, who was the reporter on this story, described Studio C as a burgeoning pop culture phenomenon that has racked up more than 1 billion views on YouTube, about a third the number of Saturday Night Live. Studio C's success, flying in the face of comedy's subversive ethos, is an irony not lost on university officials.
But what he didn't include in that article, though, is the obvious reality that over 1 billion clicks came from the Studio C cast members and their friends themselves just like watching videos over and over and over and over again. So they've racked up the numbers. It's false inflation. That's what I'm arguing. And if anybody from Studio C wants to come on the show and refute that, we welcome you.
Is this the open invitation? Like, you come out here and you show me that you didn't do this yourself.
You prove to me that you actually have 1 billion legit views on your YouTube videos.
See, the obvious easy joke here is it's Studio C. So they've got their big Mormon families, which is going to be huge. That's how you get the 1 billion views, because you've got 20 brothers and sisters. They're all doing it. Their spouses are all doing it, et cetera. You know, one eternal round, et cetera, et cetera. So here's what Michael Dunn, the managing editor of BYU Broadcasting, said. Here we have arguably the most successful university-based comedy troupe of all time. That's pretty bold. Coming from what the world would consider to be a conservative religious school, Studio C's popularity has validated the idea that, quote, the absolute sharpest comedy is clean comedy. And, Brian, because Mormons are going to Mormon no matter what, quote, still some have found reasons to be offended. One viewer wrote in to complain about a joke at the expense of a character with a hernia, saying that, quote, hernias are painful.
Oh my gosh.
End quote. Listen, are you going to deny the pain of somebody else that has a hernia, Brian?
You know, I mean, have we come to this? That's you know, that's just all I think. Have we really come to this where we can't even joke around about hernias?
Others objected to a bit where people shot at a cat. I actually think I kind of agree with this.
Yeah, that's a bit rough.
Here's my favorite. Another chastised a cast member for using the word butt, B-U-T-T, in a social media post, suggesting it would have been better to opt for derriere.
I remember that. Derriere, yeah. Yeah. What are they, a French show?
Listen, Brian, if we want those 1 billion views on YouTube, okay, we're going to have to start censoring a little bit and working. Have you ever seen Studio C, Brian?
My kids love it. Yeah, I mean, they think it's great, but they're like 13 and 11, so, you know, what
right.
do they know?
Like, that's what I found. The people who love it are either parents of, like, young teenagers, and young teenagers being like 11 to 13-year-olds, right, who are sitting there going, oh, they're laughing at something and it's clean, so I'm okay with it. Or, you know, especially if you're talking about a bunch of dads, it's about their same level of humor. Or a bunch of 13-year-olds who are like, oh, hey, this is funny. It's not bad, but... It's also not that good.
I think it's a millennial issue. And speaking of millennials, let's talk about millennials in politics, which is one of our favorite topics to talk about on this show. Especially
yes,
in the
we
age
do.
Of
Trump. Okay. So this is another one from the Huffington Post, and I won't go through and read it. I would actually check it out in the show notes if you want to read it, because what they do is they talk with a lot of different BYU students and millennial Mormons about their own personal political views. And it's interesting because all of them seem to have the same tune. They don't like saying they feel that they're in the middle, but they don't like saying that because all of a sudden people start wanting to fight with them about, well, what do you think about this? What do you think about this? So here's a quote from Riley Mattson. I don't even feel comfortable saying that I'm in the middle. Only the people who don't give a crap about whatever, I'm sorry. Only the people who don't give a hoot, because we're going to edit it because we're trying to be like Studio C, about what anyone else says are very political about their politics at this time. Mattson isn't alone. In dozens of interviews conducted by BYU journalism students in partnership with Huffington Post, Utah college students reported feeling estranged from the two-party system and reluctant to talk politics for fear of ostracization by their peers. Brian, like I said, this story is an interesting story if you want to read a bunch of situations. And I'm not saying that they are necessarily wrong. I actually think there's a lot more legitimacy to there. My question is this. They're phrasing it like this is a Mormon issue. They're actually phrasing it like it could be a Utah issue, too, considering the way that most Mormons in Utah feel about Donald Trump, and specifically the fact that he almost, well, at least in polls, they said they didn't want to support him, although once they got behind the curtain, they actually did it. I'm going to take a different stance. I don't think this is about Mormons. I don't think this is about Utahns. I think this is about millennials in general. And that's the connection I wish they would have done, because if they would have gone up to BYU Idaho, they might have found a different situation. If they would have gone to a place, another highly Mormon populated place, like I think Arizona State has a decent Mormon population, or even Southern Virginia, they might have found a different thing. I think this is millennials. I don't think they like being typecast into, oh, you are a conservative or you are a Republican or a Democrat or a liberal. Therefore, you have to believe A through Z. You're not allowed to go through and pick and choose, because I think that's what older generations are used to. You have to buy completely in. And millennials, at least in my opinion, they're not like that at all.
Yeah, if they're anything, they're label rejectors, right? But they're also so fiercely independent that they're like everybody else at the same time. But what you're saying basically is that the sample pooling here was not necessarily representative. Is that right?
Yeah.
But yet, this seems to be a generational thing.
Yeah. Well, I think that's where I'm confused about the whole thing, because they were making it sound like, oh, you better watch out for the Mormon millennials that are out there. But at the same time, I could grab my own group of Mormon millennials and be like, guys, listen, I went to school at BYU Provo or at BYU Idaho, okay? They are the reddest county, right? Madison County is the reddest county in the entire United States. I think they voted like 99.3% Republican during the 2008 election, or maybe it was 2012. I don't remember which one. Anyways, I don't know if we could say that that's exactly like that. Now, the other thing I wonder, too, if the current political environment is also playing a big factor in all this stuff. So I will say this. We had all those nice talks about Provo. I think this might factor into it a little bit, that you're seeing a lot more diversity there, that Provo is not becoming the homogenous place that it used to be. But at the same time, I don't know if I'm ready to paint all millennial Mormons on that same brush.
So, Brant, how are we going to handle this next story? This is kind of a weird one.
Okay. So I will say by the outset, we are not going to reference the individual that they are talking about by name. You're going to hear a bleep there. And there's a few reasons for that. A, I don't want to give this person the airtime. B, frankly, I find his name a bit offensive for a lot of our listeners. There was a post on medium.com by an individual named Mary Snap, AKA Jesse Stay. And they tracked an individual for the LDS Church. Now, this individual was very prominent. He had been sharing videos that he had recorded with a hidden camera inside the LDS temple and claimed to have a video of Mitt Romney in the temple as he was going to expose him during his campaign for president. So this individual was contracted or worked for the LDS Church Information Security Group to combat people spamming Mormon.org. They found out that he was really good at it and said, hey, let's start going after this individual. So he's been tracking him and trying to find him, and he ends up finding him and going through all this stuff. But it is a salacious tale of, oh, that's some good internet sleuthing, and oh, that's some good social engineering, whatever you want to call it. But I want to read this part at the end. And Brian, we need to talk about this, okay? Why am I sharing this? This is what Jesse Stay or Mary Snap writes. Why am I sharing this? I'm sharing this to make the point that the LDS Church, while trying to protect its own existence and the security of its members and leaders, does track certain members. I never once heard the term strengthening the members committee, which is his quote, not mine, while I was there. Everything I did was to try and protect the church's image and the security of its members. I was also told they don't necessarily condone the creation of fake profiles like I do. He created a fake Facebook profile, but they never told me to stop when I said I was doing it. I was a small cog in a much larger machine built to protect the image of the church, just doing my job. They appreciated the information I was giving them and was helping them with. I don't share this to hurt the church in any way, but I do think it's important for others to know the LDS Church does track security threats, and they have some of the most talented individuals in the world working for them to do so. So even if you're in a private or secret group, always remember there are people watching, either from the COB, the church office building, or members going rogue and trying to report it to the church office building. So Brian, like I said, this is a salacious tale. It was a fascinating read. I don't think this would be a surprise for any of us that have been in the online world for any amount of time at all. I think that the Strengthening the Church Members Committee is legitimate. I mean, we know it's a legitimate group, but I think that a lot of people want to frame it as a boogeyman, and it was definitely that way back in the early 90s. I think that they've evolved a little bit based on conversations that I've had with certain individuals. My understanding is that they've evolved not to focus on, okay, who's the bad guys out there, but more to focus on who are the people that are influential and what are they saying and how could we be listening to that? So I got to ask, what was the point of this story other than to be salacious and get clicks? Because it made a lot of traction. I know it was passed around from a lot of friends. I'm not sure if you saw it, Brian.
Yeah, I definitely saw it. And I think that if anything, it was because of the timing, because this individual who has been going into temples and filming was going on a certain podcast. That's a very popular podcast, probably one of the most popular Mormon themed podcasts. And I think that knowing that that individual is going to be going on that podcast prompted Jesse Stay to kind of come out with this story and say, hey, you know, here's what I'd been working on regarding this individual. But, you know, it is a bit of a cautionary tale at the same time, right?
Right. I mean, I think it's a cautionary tale in the same way that just posting anything on the internet is a cautionary tale. You have to be careful about what you say. If I post something about a competitor and people can trace it back to me and my current employer, they might sit there and go, it'd be easier for them to report it and go, hey, do you know your employee's posting stuff like this? Now, granted, it becomes a very different dynamic when you're talking about a church. And I think that's where this has caused so much consternation, whether it be that Strengthening the Church Members Committee or what Jesse Stay was doing, in the sense of, well, wait a minute, why is the church looking into people like this? So, Brian, the ethical question is this. Is the church allowed to do this? That's not very good, because I think that they can do whatever they want. There's nothing legally prohibiting them from doing it. Should the church be doing something like this?
Well, I mean, I, from my perspective, I don't see an issue with it. But then again, I'm also not somebody who's going out of my way to try to do things which damage or embarrass the church. So, you know, I feel pretty safe in my comfortable little zone. You ask anybody who has a beef with the church and would like to see the church knock down a few pegs, and maybe they'd say, no, the church has no right to spy on me like this. But, you know, let's face it. If you're out there throwing stones at it, it's, I don't know, do they not have a right to defend themselves to some extent?
I think this is where the complexity of it comes in, because I'm legitimately torn on this issue. Like I said, I think about it from my own personal employment standpoint, and yeah, I could see it that way. And I think about it from, there's this interesting dynamic of people claiming the title of Mormon, whatever that might be. And that's a completely different discussion for another day. But claiming that title and then wanting to talk as if they were like other Mormons to try and sway certain individuals or sway certain mindsets. That's something else. I also sit there and go, I don't know. It's kind of, I don't want to use the word inspiring. It's interesting to note that they are monitoring certain people, certain influential people who are both very negative towards the church, but I would also say very positive towards the church. And I sit there and say, okay, so why is that? Are they using them as test pilots? Are they using them to say, this is an issue that is very sensitive for everybody? I don't think that's always the case, because if that were the case, maybe they would have approached the November 5th policy a little bit differently instead of completely fumbling the ball on that with everything involved with that. But at the same time, I don't know. I'm kind of with you. Look, if you're going to, let's say you're disaffected from the church, okay? And you view the church as the big bully. If you're going to throw rocks at the big bully and the big bully finally gets sick of it and says, you're done. That's one thing. I think what becomes dangerous is when someone is taking this information and funneling it to people and saying, hey, did you know that Brandt said this? Hey, did you know that Brandt said this? Hey, here's an entire, 3-inch thick folder of every single tweet or every single Facebook status that Brandt has ever said about the LDS Church. That I think that is
that feels legitimately invasive.
Yeah. And so I, on the one hand, I get it. But on the other hand, I don't know if I'll just come out with it. I don't know if I trust them to have all that information and to make the right choices, because you're dealing with a lot of individuals. Whereas I think about from a corporate perspective, I am an employee of my company, and certain things I say and do can be reflective of the company. And so therefore they have a vested interest in me saying certain things or not saying other things. But we also have I work for them. I get paid for them. We've had that sort of relationship. We don't have that in the church.
So here's what I'm hoping that this won't boil down to, and this will be a segment into our top story of the week and the last story that we're going to discuss before we go to break. I'm hoping that we don't end up in this situation where we're doing all this data collection and data mining in order to determine worthiness of individuals filtered down to the local level at some point. And I'm thinking 20, 30 years down the road or whatever, when getting optics on people is just like super connected with everything that they do online. You know what I'm saying? So I'm hoping that that doesn't interfere with, kids who want to go out in missions, for instance, and who maybe have done some things on social media that they're not particularly proud of, and now they're trying to turn their lives around and get out on a mission. I hope it doesn't come back to haunt them. Because speaking of which, there's new missionary interview questions.
Look at that professional segue. Oh, man. Folks, this is what you get with the Mormon News Report.
This is why we ask for your $1 contribution to our Patreon feed so that we can continue to bring you this kind of professional coverage and transitions from one story to the next.
Okay, so even though you made that professional segue, I've got to like pull it back just a second. There's one thing I do need to add because you brought up the optics of the whole thing. I think that and this leads into the missionary story, but I think that it starts becoming very concerning if, for example, when you're going into a temple recommend interview, and I think that we could have an interesting discussion on the ethics or the purpose of temple recommend interviews and how people view those. But if you go in for a temple recommend interview and sitting there are the temple recommend questions and then a list of all your tweets, or in our case, a list of transcripts of every single podcast that we've done, and a ecclesiastical leader wants to sit there and go, okay, Brant, I want you to tell me what you meant about this whole thing right here. I want you to tell me about this tweet that you sent back on September 22nd, 2012. That's when it starts becoming concerning. But we still got about 20 or 30 years down the road for that stuff. So we're good, right? We don't need to worry about that. Let's talk first about what's going to be happening very soon, this new missionary interview question. So this was a letter that was sent to general authorities, Area 70s, state mission and district presidents, bishops, and branch presidents. Let me just read it very briefly. Dear brethren, thank you for your work and help prospective missionaries prepare to serve full-time missions. Your efforts help prepare them spiritually, physically, and emotionally for the rigors of missionary service. Effective interviews are an essential part of preparing missionaries. To improve that, we ask priesthood leaders to use the enclosed standard questions when interviewing all prospective missionaries. Leaders should also share these questions with youth well in advance of the interview. The questions should also be shared with each missionary candidate's parents. So, Ryan, the questions are some fairly standard questions that you would see on any temple recommend. Should not be a surprise to anybody. But a few things that did stand out to me. There were quite a few sections where they would say, share your testimony about blank. So, for example, share your testimony about the restoration or the prophet Joseph Smith. Share your testimony about the atonement. There were questions where it would be, what do you understand about the following standards? Chastity, pornography, tithing, the word of wisdom, the Sabbath day, honesty. And then we get into some interesting ones. Have you ever sexually abused a child in any way, regardless of whether or not you were charged, you were convicted, or the record was expunged? So that's an interesting one, and it almost seems out of context within the entire section.
Yeah, but it's an ongoing issue, though. So I can see why it's becoming part of this.
Brian, it's a valid question, and in a sense, it amazes me that it hasn't been asked before, because even if 999,000 out of 1,000, 999,000 out of 1 million interviews that a bishop, branch president, or stake president will do with prospective missionaries, even if 999,000 of those come back as no, the fact that there might be one out there that might say yes, it's worth it for that question. So then we get into this next section, and I wish we had some Eeyore sound, Brian, because I'm going to be a total Eeyore on this. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 questions, all regarding people's mental states. For example, have you ever been diagnosed with or receiving treatment for dyslexia or other reading disorders? If so, are you comfortable reading the scriptures and other documents out loud? Do you believe that you could memorize appropriate scriptures and other information with the assistance of your companion? Have you ever been diagnosed with or received treatment for a speech disorder? If so, are you comfortable speaking in front of others? Have you ever been on medication or otherwise treated for any of the following conditions? Attention deficit disorder, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, anxiety, depression, obsessive compulsive disorder, or autism spectrum disorder, including Asperger's? Yeah. If yes, please explain. And then the last one that is in our section, and we need to talk about this. If you're treated for one of these conditions and discontinued treatment, well, we don't need to talk about this question in particular, just all these questions. Did you do so under a doctor's supervision? If not, why did you stop? How well have you been functioning without treatment or medication? When was the last time you were on medication for these issues? Okay. I will be honest, Brian, and I want to get your thoughts on this. When I first read these, I was like, oh, no. And this is the reason why. We have someone from our ward who just went out on a mission. He is going on a pilot mission that the church has started doing. I'm not sure if you've heard about this, where they will find a mission close to your geographic area. They will pilot you out there for 3 months. You will go directly out there for 3 months. And after 3 months, you will have a discussion with your mission president about your feelings and your capacity to continue serving. If you decide that it is not within your capacity to continue serving, you are given a full and honorable release. If you do feel it is within your capacity to serve, you can either stay there and labor in that mission for the rest of your time, or, and this is where we're not exactly sure about how all this works, you can be sent to the MTC and then you will be reassigned out somewhere throughout the country. So it was very touching to hear that, and especially because he got up in sacrament meeting for his farewell talk and basically said, I struggle with depression and I struggle with anxiety and I'm on medication and it's something that has been a struggle for me and I didn't think it was going to be a hindrance to me serving a mission. It was a very raw and touching and needed talk with regard to him going out and serving, because I told him afterwards, it's so important that I work with the young men. It's so important that all these young men are looking at you and hearing this, because then they can sit there and go, oh, if he can do it, I can do it. That being said, I read these questions and I sit there and say, I hope that it is going to be done in a spirit of love and concern and understanding, but I'm so concerned that this will become an administrative function where someone's going to go, you got ADD. I don't think you're fit to serve. We're going to do you on a different type of mission. And because these new missions aren't necessarily commonplace yet, because we're not necessarily comfortable with it, they're in the eyes of many, and they might not talk about it. It might be deep down within them, but in the eyes of many, they don't view them as legit missions because, well, you didn't do the 2-year door knocking that I did. You didn't, you know, knock your knuckles raw and walk till you have blisters on your feet. And that's my biggest concern, that we're gonna use this like an administrative checklist. And I'm worried about that. Like, I think it's good, but that's a worry that I have. Am I completely off base?
No, you're not. I don't think so. There's a couple thoughts that I have. One positive, and the other that's a concern. The concern side is I'm concerned that now that kids are going to know what questions are going to be facing before they go in there, I'm concerned that there'll be less kids that will be inclined to want to go through this interview, and who will just say I don't want to go on a mission, just to avoid having to go through this kind of invasive interview. right, with their bishop or whoever it is that's conducting this interview.
Now they said it. they're gonna give them the questions. Right. Like it's not gonna be.
I mean, it could scare the crap out of a kid, right? And it's like, oh man, I'm never gonna pass this. So they'd almost rather just say, I'm not interested in a mission, right? So, you know,
I think that's the key. I'm never gonna pass it. Why bother?
So that's a concern that I have, and that's a concern, incidentally, that Robert Kirby shared, and he put this on the Salt Lake Tribune this week. Great article, and I think it was titled something along the lines of, "Would there have been an Elder Kirby if these questions existed then?" Right. So. He may not have made it out in the mission field. Number two, this is on the positive side. I really, really hope that we can change our minds about what it means to serve in an effective mission and get away from this nonsense that every mission that isn't proselytizing mission is somehow beneath the ideal of the proselyting mission, right? So I hope that we can create more service missions, because there's a lot of kids who may have a hard time out there doing the discussions, knocking on the doors, being part of the traditional proselyting type mission, who would do excellent in some sort of a service related mission and have a wonderful, fulfilling experience. And so I hope that the church actually uses this data, as opposed to excluding kids from missions, actually uses this data to customize and create better missions that hopefully become the norm within Mormonism, to where it isn't just expected that, oh, well, if your kid got the non proselyting mission, then obviously there's something wrong with him, right?
Brian, let me just wrap up with this. I think we want to make this our question of the week. So if anyone has any thoughts on these new questions, do you think it's going to be a positive? Do you think it's going to be a negative? What are your hopes? What are your concerns? Email us at mail@mormonnewsreport.com, or you can tweet at us @TheMormonNews, or you can send us a Facebook message. Just search for The Mormon News Report on Facebook and you can send us there. And we'll be back with Stephen Peck.
Have you ever been listening to an interview and get frustrated because just as they're getting to the good stuff, they end it? Are you the type of person who wants to be on the cutting edge of breaking Mormon news? Did your doctor recommend you increase your snark quotient every day as part of a well-balanced Mormon diet? Do you feel a moral imperative to support independent Mormon journalism and the Mormon News Report podcast? Then consider becoming a Patreon member to the Mormon News Report podcast. For just $1 or more per month, you can get access to our entire back catalog of Mormon News Report podcasts. Want to know what we thought of the 2017 October General Conference? It's in there. Want to know about that one Brant rant that had you scratching your head wondering, where is he going with this? It's in there too. As a Patreon subscriber to the Mormon News Report podcast, you also get a special podcast link to the Mormon News Report extended sessions, where we roll up our sleeves and get intimate with our interview guests. And we always leave a choice insider nugget for your support. Your generous contribution helps us to produce the best in Mormon news with just a sprinkling of snark. So consider becoming a Mormon News Report Patreon subscriber today. Just go to patreon.com, that's patreon.com, and search for Mormon News Report, or go to patreon.com/Mormon News Report and become a subscriber today. We'd like to welcome onto the show Stephen Peck. Stephen is an evolutionary biologist, blogger, poet, and novelist. His prolific body of work includes nonfiction, science, essays, science articles, essays, fiction, and poetry. He is most known in LDS circles as the author of The Scholar of Moab, A Short Stay in Hell, and his recent book by BCC Press titled Science, The Key to Theology. Today we're talking to Stephen about his new fiction novel published by Roundfire Books titled Gilda Trillum, Shepherdess of the Rats. I hope I pronounced that, Stephen. Stephen, it's great to have you on the show. Is that how you pronounce her last name, Trillum?
Yes, Trillum. So Gilda Trillum, and you hit it right. Good job.
Perfect. So you're a really busy guy. How on earth do you find time to write? You're teaching, you're writing, you're blogging, you're doing all this stuff, and then you publish this book. Where do you find the time?
You know, it keeps me sane. It's one of those things that I do that if I don't do, I start to like build up some emotional baggage, and writing becomes this mechanism for just kind of clearing my mind and getting things out that I need to get out. If that makes sense.
So. It does. And I know that that's something that I back when I was doing the Mormon News Report daily email, it was something where I had to, I actually scheduled it on my work calendar where I would get into work really early because I had to schedule that time to write or else it just wasn't going to happen. And it sounds like it's kind of the same for you. It's got to be done or else you kind of start going a little loopy, maybe?
Yeah, yeah. At night, I just sit down and I just start going and I can tell when I'm on because I'll just completely lose track of time. 3 hours will go by and boom. I don't even notice.
So give me a little bit of background on Gilda Trillum, who is the subject of your book. And just to set this up, the story takes place from the perspective of a grad student in literature named Kat Mender, who is writing her thesis about Gilda Trillum. So who is Gilda?
So Gilda is a world-class badminton player, poet, and really a curious explorer of the nature of the world. Most of what she's trying to do is just figure out existence, what it's like, why am I here, what am I supposed to do? And it's her journey, a life journey. I mean, it covers almost her whole life over the course of the book. And in some ways, she's kind of an alter ego, but in other ways, she's completely different. I sort of fell in love with her as I wrote. She became nearly real to me. She was somebody I thought about, I wondered about. And when I write, something that surprises a lot of people is I write very organically. There is very rarely kind of a layout, a plot layout. This is where it's going. This is where it's going to end. It almost just unfolds like I'm really exploring, like I was Kat, exploring the life of this, except I know I'm writing it, but I'm completely surprised by what happens.
So, Stephen, how did this character of Gilda Trillum sort of manifest? I mean, were there just kind of little bits and pieces that you kind of pulled from just your environment? You're like, this is part of who this person is. Like, she's just such a rich and fascinating character. I'm curious how you birthed her.
So that's kind of interesting. I was playing around with sort of literary devices. And I wrote this post at By Common Consent about an imaginary woman writer that wrote what I called minimalist novels. And what I meant by that was she just gives you like a list of nouns, a list of verbs, a list of prepositions, and then the novel's constructed. And I imagine these literary debates on what purpose do her novels serve. And so I wrote up this kind of tongue-in-cheek exploration from some literary scholars on By Common Consent as a piece of fiction. What surprised me, though, is, and I left all these clues that this was just a fictional Mormon writer. Like, I put in links that if you clicked on said, this person does not exist in your time dimension, or you know, lots of little things like that. But nobody clicked on the links. And it ended up a whole bunch of people really were sort of surprised when I revealed, no, she's not real. And I took some flack for that, actually. The greatest.
So kind of like Scott Hale's Garden of Enid, right? A lot of people assume that Enid
was a real person. Yeah.
This was like an autobiography that, right. You know, or journal that, right, that this 14-year-old girl was posting. So similar, except, yeah.
Yeah, the greatest line I got, though, in the comment section was somebody said, when I go to the internet, I expect to be, I expect the truth. And I thought, poor person.
You're way off. Good luck with that one.
Yeah. They've got so much to learn. You know, I will fully admit this. I Googled Gilda Trillum because I did. Because I was like, no, this has got to be. But I think that goes to show, Stephen, just how well you wrote the character. Because No. This has got to be legit. This has got to be real. And it wasn't.
Right. But she became so real to me. I mean, I think that came across in the writing. It just, she was a genuine, real person in my mind. And as the story unfolded and some of the details, I mean, sometimes I'd just be in weepy eyed thinking, oh my word, this is really going in strange directions. So
speaking of weepy eyed, So I was reading this book, and my wife is used to me, you know, having a stack of four books by my bedside and trying to, you know, blaze through all these because we're doing a lot of it for the show. And so she was like, what are you reading a book about? And I told her the title of the book, and she's like, like, she was not impressed. But come to find out, the rats really were their own character in the book. And if you would have told me that I would have had a spiritual connection with rats, I don't know if I would have believed you. I almost feel asking this question, considering the effect that the book had on me, especially in one of the more dramatic parts of the book where the rats really become a full-fledged character. But was there a reason you chose something as disgusting to many people as rats in your book? Was there a reason behind that? Is there something more there?
I think I was trying to capture sort of the horrors that Gilda was going through at the time. How low she had sunk, and especially, and I don't want to give a spoiler too much, but when the rats essentially save her life and the method that they do it in, to me, it's hard to talk about this because it's my book, but it was really a moving scene to me. It really captured, I think, sort of the depredation she'd been through, the things that she'd experienced. And it was, in any human life, that would have been an extreme low point. And in that act of redemption, to me, it was just what had to happen. And that's where they kind of emerged, actually.
And again, I'm with you. I don't want to give too many spoilers out because people really need to read that entire chapter of the book. But I almost felt that there was, and that's the reason why I was asking, it was an act of redemption and, in essence, physical salvation. They were physically saving her by doing what they did. And there is something very beautiful about having something as low and base and disgusting as a rat do something like that. And it might be me projecting my own personal weird views on things, but I'm sitting here going, yeah, that's kind of like us. Like, we're desperately trying to help other people, and we're just as base and low as rats as that. So I really appreciated that, and I thought that was that was just great. But yeah, like I said, I told her it was a book about rats. I told my wife it was a book about rats, and she's like, nah, you go ahead and read that. I'm not going to pick that one up after you're done.
It makes it hard to convince people to read. You know, it's got such an odd title. I have this problem with all my books, though. You know, when I tell people The Scholar Moab is about a high school dropout and a two-headed cowboy, it's kind of like, I'm going to leave that one alone.
So Brian and I were talking before the show about your book, and I think I said the word wow about 15 times. You tackle Mother in Heaven, you tackle doubt, chaos and agency, miracle, spirituality, everything. And the phrase that Brian used was, he called it fearless. Is there something about the medium of fiction that allows you to give your examination of these things such a unique view versus just, writing prose as far as, okay, here's my thoughts on chaos and agency versus using a medium like fiction to explore the space a little bit more?
Well, you know, I actually think fiction, I tell people this and they rarely believe me, but I tell to my students, I say that there's more truth in fiction than there is in science. And what I mean by that is fiction allows you to explore the edges. In fact, Adam Miller's got a great essay on this about how truth becomes manifest through fiction. He wrote a tongue-in-cheek article, has this idea of, why Jesus loves novels. And I think there's great power in novels that you really can't reach because I don't know if you're familiar with this Danish philosopher named Kierkegaard, but he wrote that the greatest truths are those that we incorporate into ourselves and we compare with ourselves, and for me, fiction allows that. It allows you to go into existential depth about not only the truths themselves but what they mean to me, and that manifests their power, I think. So for me, fiction is a very powerful medium. It can be. It's not necessarily a powerful medium, but it can be. And I think that's why I like it so much. It does allow me to explore things that if I tried to write an essay or a blog post about, it would you'd consider it and you think, here are the pros and the cons. But fiction allows you to explore things in unique ways that I think are just essential to life and being human. So I'm a huge fiction fan.
So there's something I kind of want to get into a little bit. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt there. When you're saying that, I think of myself in the position that I'm in. I have a history background, and we deal with the documentary record. We're trying to piece together what we think the past looked like, and really kind of analyze change over time. Really, that's kind of what history is best at doing, is looking at change, right, change over time. But I get people that approach me and say they treat history as if they're going to get this grand truth out of it, and I just want to know the truth. Is what they say. Right. And my common response to that is basically what you just said. If it's the truth that you're looking for, you're better off finding it in the work of fiction, in poetry, in theater, in music, in these things that transcend the human experience, right?
Exactly.
Because that's where the truth of human existence comes out. And if that's what you're looking for, you're in the wrong place if you're looking at a history book.
I believe that. I actually believe that. I think... And that's why I think I enjoy writing fiction more than anything. I write a lot of science too, but I really enjoy fiction because I'm exploring things in ways that I just couldn't do in any other way. You can then try it on for yourself and see what moves you, what truths do you discover, and that's the power of poetry, I think, too, as well, is that poetry ideally should give you an experience, often maybe not even the same one the poet thought that she was giving, but the poetry sort of elicits or draws out of you an experience that allows you to discover truths about yourself or about the world or about anything.
So there's some very, and this leads into this theme that we've been talking about with the fiction, but there's some very chilling and dark recollections of Gilda while she was a prisoner of war in the Vietnam camp, which is a lot where the rats come in.
Right.
So I want to read this section to you, and I want to get your thoughts on it. Gilda writes, "Despite the oppressive heat, I sat shivering and trembling on that bench, knowing that I was helpless to whatever harms were presented to me. Whatsoever was handed to me, I would take. I went numb for hours or maybe days, oblivious to sense. Not like a Buddhist monk whose thoughts have been quieted through mindfulness and attention. No, my mind was shocked to stillness like a piston frozen because no motor oil lubed the engine. I woke during one of the nights on our journey late. In the headlights of some car following us, I could see that both the guards and my fellow prisoners were asleep, lightly as people do in a moving vehicle, maintaining some modicum of posture to keep from sliding to the floor. But even so, their heads were bobbing on their shoulders loosely and unconsciously. Waves after waves of panic and fear bubbled in me. My breath became gasps for air that I could not obtain. It felt like I was being held underwater. I felt doomed. I felt damned. I reached out. I called upon the God of my youth. I set my mind heavenward, pleading for him to take me back into his care. I knew I had abandoned him. I thought of the picture I'd seen on Sunday. I thought of the pictures I'd seen in Sunday school as a child in Idaho of Jesus with the soft chestnut brown hair smiling down on a child. And I begged, help me, Jesus. Help me now. I'm lost. The truck rolled onward into the night. Why would he come to me? I had abandoned him long ago. And yet I hoped. I wanted to believe that someone somewhere was aware of what I was feeling and it mattered. Calmness drifted over me for a second, as if we were seeking a worthy vessel. But as I tried to reach out to it, it fled. I cried silently, alone." This, I was reading this and my jaw was on the floor because it seems like so many people struggle to find that despair that you're describing. And I'll be honest, and I don't mean to put anyone else on blast, but when I read a lot of other mainstream authors who try and encapsulate it, it seems like they gloss it over. Why is it that we can't seem to get these feelings right, but you were able to encapsulate it? Like, what is holding us back from fully examining this despair that you described?
I think it's dangerous. I don't think we want to believe that we could be left alone at a time. And part of that comes out of, genuine experience. When I was on my honeymoon, my wife and I were in a head-on with a drunk driver, and we were severely injured, and we were recuperating at her parents' house. And I remember walking out in the garden and feeling that despair and just reaching out, why? We were doing everything right. We just got married in the temple. We followed the script exactly right. this kind, you know, that morning we prayed, watch over us as we travel, that we'll be safe. And we weren't. And I could not get my head around it. I couldn't. And I reached out just like that and saying, why? And where are you? And it was just nothing. Emptiness. I just got nothing. And that's not the narrative I think we like telling. We like telling the narrative where rescue comes every time and, you know, we're always, we're, that's always available. But so many people that I've talked to actually experienced it this way, and the way Gilda's experiencing, where you're confronting genuine and gut-wrenching darkness and you don't feel rescued. And even though later, you know, I worked through this and it took time, it wasn't the immediate, you know, hand in, out of the heavens. And it really took effort and wondering and trying to figure out how things work that sort of is getting written into Gilda in that description. You know, it's I don't think it's that uncommon to experience that sense of abandonment. And the narrative that we often give, though, is, you know, you're never alone. But sometimes it feels that way, you know. And to recognize that, and I think literature is an appropriate place to explore that and see, you know, what kinds of, what's the fullness of human experience. And I think that's what literature is about. It's not about you know, a morality tale where everything works out. It can be that kind of thing that I think actually has salvific attributes that allows a deeper exploration of how existence plays out in life.
I love that, and I totally think that that's kind of where my mind was through all this. Stephen, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Do you have a couple of minutes to stick around at the end of the show for a few more questions that we have for you?
Oh, sure. I'd love to.
Awesome. You can find Gilda Trillum, Shepherdess of the Rats, through any major book retailer or online through Amazon.com, and we'll be right back.
Apologetics can be defined as a defense of faith through argumentation. Christian apologetics comprise some of the earliest forms of Christian writings. Throughout the centuries, apologists have argued for the reality of God, legitimacy of Scripture, the creation, the fall, the preeminence of grace, and the eschatology of the end times. Adding to these, Mormon apologists have defended Joseph Smith's first vision, the embodiment of God, continuing revelation, extra-biblical scripture and temple rituals, among other topics, and have reached new levels of sophistication through training in fields such as history, philosophy, and Near Eastern languages and culture. Through multiple perspectives, the contributors to this volume explore the textures and contours of apologetics, revealing deep ideological fissures within the Mormon studies community concerning its utility. In spite of these deep-seated differences, what each author has in common is a passion for Mormonism and how it is presented and defended. This volume captures that reality and allows readers to encounter the terrain of Mormon apologetics at close range. Learn more about perspectives on Mormon theology, apologetics, by visiting gregcoford.com.
And now for your moment in history, brought to you by our friends at todayinmormonhistory.com. October 20th, what day is this? October 20th, 1982. I was thinking 1892. October 20th, 1982. The LDS Church purchases a letter written by David Whitmer for $10,000. The letter is purchased from Mark Hoffman and is one of his forgeries. Gordon B. Hinckley has authorized $15,000 for the purchase, but Hoffman reduced the price in a show of goodwill. Brian, that is adorable, a show of goodwill.
You know, that was so nice of Hoffman to knock $5,000 off the ticket of his forgery. Now, look, Brian, I know that a lot of people get all worked up over this because they're like, well, if Gordon B. Hinckley was a true prophet, then wouldn't he have known that it's a forgery? As if, like, being a prophet and a messenger of God has anything to do with being able to see through somebody's, you know, forged documents and be an expert on documentary records and all that kind of stuff. So give him a break, for crying out loud. Gordon B. Hinckley was a human being.
I will just say this. Anyone who's interested in Mark Hoffman needs to read, I believe it's the, gosh, I can't remember off the top of my head. There's a great biography. We'll link to it in the show notes, but there's a great biography of Mark Hoffman. Basically, what was happening at the time, a lot of people actually did know that they were forgeries, but it was the 80s. They couldn't get the information out fast enough because, but Brian, wasn't stuff happening in like the eastern part of the United States with some U.S. history things that he was forging and selling where they were like, whoa, 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 something's not right with this.
Yeah. Yeah, that is true. And I haven't read that biography, so my history on Mark Hoffman is probably not that fantastic. I'm just going by the snarky comments that I see people, you know, lobbing at President Hinckley online.
Listen, on the internet, Brian, nobody knows that you're not an expert. And that's our show. We'd like to thank Stephen Peck for joining us. Scott Holmes provided the music. Brian Whitney edited and produced today's show. Don't forget to check out our Patreon feed with the extended session interview with Stephen Peck. Here's a clip.
Things of the world don't reveal themselves in totality, no matter how hard you try. There's always a sense of things uncaptured, you know, whether you looked at it scientifically or artistically, or just tried to you know, say, I understand this completely. And it speaks to the limits of knowledge. And the sacrament cup speaks to the clarity of experience. And so that was a really obscure juxtaposition, you know, in different ends of the book. So
just visit patreon.com/Mormon News Report and become a subscriber today.
And if you like what we're doing, then help us get the word out. You know, sharing a review on, or putting a review on iTunes would be the best. That really helps us with our search rankings. But, you know, sharing our show on social media, doing a little share button on Facebook, doing a little share on Twitter, it really helps get the word out that, hey, we've got this show, and I hope you're enjoying it.
And Brian, I will say this. I don't think you and I are going to complain if someone wants to tag us and say, can you believe the bat bleep crazy stuff that Brant said on this last interview? I will actually just laugh if people tag me and do that. So there you go.
Yeah. And so share us even if you hate us. Like, look how ridiculous this show is.
And don't forget, you can also send hate mail or fan mail to mail@MormonNewsReport.com. We'll be back next week with more news, commentary, and interviews with a little bit of snark. Until then, we'll talk to you again after a while.